This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Trent Reznor, is best known for the music he's made under the name Nine Inch Nails. Some of his songs became anthems of teenage anger and depression. Recently, he's moved into writing music for movies. Last year, he won an Oscar for co-writing the score for The Social Network. The director of that film, David Fincher, asked Reznor and co-composer Atticus Ross to write the score for Fincher's new film, the American adaptation of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which opens this week. In 1997, Spin magazine named Reznor the most vital person in music, saying that he seems like a visionary, the first rock star to make synthesizers cool for teenage headbangers. In 2004, Rolling Stone placed Reznor on its list of the 100 greatest artists of all time. And in the citation, David Bowie wrote that there's never been better soul-lashing in rock than on Nine Inch Nails' album, The Downward Spiral. Let's start with music Reznor co-wrote for a threatening scene in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. It's music Trent Reznor co-composed for the new film, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Trent Reznor, welcome to Fresh Air. This is the second film that you've scored for David Fincher. The first was The Social Network. What's the process like? Do you sit down and watch the film over and over and get the mood in your head before you sit down to write?
No, when I say we, is my partner Atticus Ross and myself. We employed the same methodology, really, on both films, and that was, with this one in particular, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, we started about 14 months ago, and it was right when David Fincher was heading to Sweden to start filming, and we didn't have the script, and we had not seen a frame of footage, but I'd spoken with David at length about kind of what he visualized the shape of the sound to be, and right off the bat he said, I don't want to use an orchestra, I'd like things to sound textural. I want to create the sound of coldness emotionally and also physically.
So let's hear some more music from The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. And this is, I think of this as having the kind of like a theme for the film. It's not like the theme song or anything, but it's repeated. So on the soundtrack, it's called Hidden in Snow. And that's music that my guest Trent Reznor co-composed for the new American version of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. There's something so industrial machine-like about not the keyboard part, but what's going, that kind of whooshing, pulsing thing behind it. What did you use to get that sound?
We wanted to take lots of acoustic instruments, from strings to lots of different bell instruments and prepared piano, which is what's featured in Hidden in Snow quite a bit, and transplant them into a very inorganic setting and kind of dress the set around them with electronics. So you were hearing a lot of live modular synthesizers creating a kind of icy or pulsing bed with something that feels very non-electronic, an organic and an imperfect instrument played imperfectly sitting on top of that, and that's kind of one of the templates we use for this film.
A prepared piano is when you open up the lid and you kind of stick stuff on the piano string so it doesn't sound like it typically should. What did you prepare it with?
We picked up a bunch of upright pianos for cheap, and then we just started trying things from clothespins to nailing nails into where the strings go, some of it ruining the instrument, some of it just creating imperfections so that you'd have to learn to play certain melodies a certain way because certain keys wouldn't work, certain notes would ring in funny ways, create interesting interactions between the notes. And it's a very hit-and-miss procedure and also very volatile because you might get something good, but when you the melody you're looking for, the string changes or the clothespin pops off or the item that's sitting on top of the strings buzzing just right isn't there when you go back to that note. And it's a frustrating but fun process to go through.
In a way, the kind of sound that you get when you're doing your more kind of industrial soundscape kind of stuff, it's in a way the kind of sound that we're constantly trying to block out because there's constantly like soda machines that are like buzzing in the background or, you know, like some kind of like washing machine that you're trying to tune out or a refrigerator that's vibrating. You know, there's so many like machines that we really try not to pay attention to. Have you ever like focused on those sounds and tried to hear like what's interesting about that?
No, very much so. And I think early on in my career, I was heavily inspired by bands like Throbbing Gristle and Test Department and films of David Lynch, for example, where the soundscape plays a very important role in the listening experience. In Nine Inch Nails' catalog, for example, as early as Downward Spiral, there was a lot of effort and experiments going on, layering in sounds that might bother you under music, to create a sense of anxiety. And I've always found that it's an interesting kind of instrument to bring into the mix, creating melody and or purpose out of noise in the various shapes noise can take, whether it could be the hum of a radiator to a room tone that could be compressed and amplified and even tuned in to kind of become something that makes you, that evokes some sort of emotional response.
So have you used, like, found sound in any of your music as opposed to, you know, like, generating it with a synthesizer or some other electronic instrument?
A good portion of what makes up a lot of the melodies in this soundtrack and certainly recent years, well, pretty much all of my work, is the result of going out in the field and sampling things. And like I said, it could be room tone, it could be a car driving by, it could be walking through a crowd of people with a mic in your pocket and just seeing what comes out of that. And taking that sound, manipulating it sometimes, stretching it or tuning it, and creating a playable instrument out of that. A lot of the melody, the melodic instruments in this record started as violins or cellos and being strummed in a certain way or bowed in a certain way, and then processed and stretched and manipulated into a setting where it may sound harmonically familiar, but if you tune into it, it's not behaving in a way that you're accustomed to that type of sound behaving, the range or the way it's articulated. And I find experimenting around in that is an interesting place to work.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails. He won an Oscar for the score he co-composed for the film The Social Network, and now he's co-composed the score for the new American adaptation of the bestseller The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Let's talk about Nine Inch Nails. Let's start with Hurt. Why don't we hear it, and then we can talk about it. And this is from the Nine Inch Nails 1994 album, The Downward Spiral.
Hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real. Kill it all away, but I remember
That's Nine Inch Nails. My guest is Trent Reznor. So can you talk about, like, the place you were in, you know, mentally when you wrote that song?
Would have been around 93. Nine Inch Nails was born out of Cleveland, Ohio, with me and a friend in a studio working on demos at night. Got a record deal with a small little label, went on tour in a van, and a couple years later found that somehow we touched a nerve and that first record resonated with a bunch of people, and it felt pretty great. And now the stakes were higher, and I felt a lot of pressure to live up to this newfound expectations from these fans. And I decided to make a kind of conceptual record that told a story of somebody that was kind of futilely trying to fill up this hole in their being with whatever it might be, whether it be sex or drugs, or to try to escape from the sense of emptiness. And I found that that created a framework where I could write these songs that all kind of made sense.
You know, it's funny, what you're describing basically is a movie. You know what I mean? A movie or a novel. You have a character, you have a whole story, and you're writing songs for it.
Well, I like the idea of working in an album-sized chunk, you know, and I never looked at Nine Inch Nails as a project that would be a hit-driven, single-based kind of thing. And I wanted to tell a story, and I wanted to be able to kind of explore different avenues in the framework of an hour-long, or however long it is, album-type format.
Don't you think a lot of your listeners have heard songs like Hurt and thought that they were autobiographical? And, you know, maybe it is partly autobiographical. Maybe you're drawing from self-knowledge, but I think a lot of listeners could hear that and think, Trent Reznor, he cut himself.
Well, the terrible irony of the story is that that story came to life, basically, over the next few years. You know, my own life kind of spiraled out of control, and I look back now and see I was writing about me. I mean, there's a lot of I's in Nine Inch Nails lyrics, particularly that era. Part of that was just a lack of skill of writing, and part of it was I learned early on that really the only thing I could say that had any integrity or truth to it was truthful things. You know, the first set of lyrics I wrote for the first songs I ever wrote, which the ones on Pretty Hate Machine, came from private journal entries that I realized were I was writing in lyric form. And when I finally had the courage to kind of marry some of those up with music, and I thought, well, this is very powerful, but I could never play it for anybody, you know, because there's no, I didn't create a character consciously. That character, it was just me, unfiltered. And I realized when I did have the courage to play it for some people that it had a strength to it, a resonance that you could tell. That kind of became the template of what Nine Inch Nails was about.
So you say that those songs that you wrote for the downward spiral about somebody who's very self-destructive and, you know, on the verge of suicide ended up being your story after that album. Did you get really close to that point of seriously considering suicide? And if it's inappropriate to ask, just tell me.
No, I think that I was somebody who was pretty immature emotionally, and when thrust into a situation that was very abnormal of fame and adulation, I wasn't really equipped to deal with it very well. And I think my life goals up to that point were just get a record deal, you know, and I thought maybe if that happened, you'd wake up one day and, wow, everything feels okay now. And as great as it was to see a lot of those dreams be realized, you know, and I can't tell you how great a feeling it is to be a kid that sat in your bedroom writing something that meant a lot to you and then see a year later being a city you've never been to and see someone in the back of a crowded room that showed up to see you sing that song, screaming those words back at you, and it means something to them that's valid. It's filled in some portion of expression for them. That's a pretty cool feeling. But anyway, as the 90s wore on, I realized that, you know, my way of coping became have a drink, and, you know, a drink led to another drink, and things progressed from there, and caught up with me, you know, and the realizing that I am an addict, and it took me a while to realize that. And then it took me a while to take the necessary steps to deal with that. And that was pretty much the 90s for me, in the late 90s at least. I wound up in a pretty bad place that I'd hope to never return to.
You know, you wrote about the shock of being alone in your bedroom writing songs and suddenly you're singing them on stage and other kids are singing along. And I'm thinking, like, there were probably so many teens who spent so much time being angry or depressed or self-hating in their bedrooms, listening to your songs and coming to your concerts and feeling this sense of, like, kinship with you.
Yeah. I mean, I saw that. And in that situation, I would feel, I could manage to turn that into something that felt isolating and negative.
How? How do you do that?
Well, you're standing on stage in a sold-out arena of people singing your music, and you feel like the loneliest person in the world, because now here's a party that essentially it's for you, and you still somehow feel like you don't belong there. You know, those people all have their lives and go back home. You get on a tour bus, and, you know, you can't say that sort of thing without sounding pathetic, and I fully realize that. But what was wrong with me was there was just an imbalance where, regardless of what was put in front of me, I could find a way to feel bad about it. You know, I just was wired that way. I could feel like I wasn't good enough. If I wrote the best song in the world, I'd never think it was that great. I could look in the mirror and see somebody that I don't like. And that's what just took me into a bad place. You know.
Were you still performing and composing during that period?
Some of which, you know, I was trying to. The record I put out in 99, The Fragile, was written in a very slippery, thin ice slope of knowing there's something wrong here and trying to address it but not embracing the treatment. And once that record came out, we went back on tour and in the worst condition I could have possibly started a year-long tour. When that tour finished, shortly thereafter, I was finished. It reached a point where I just threw my hands up and said, it's going to go one way or the other. It's either I'm going to be dead or I'm going to fix myself, because I cannot stay feeling like this. I just can't do it. I'm done. And I was done. That time, I was done.
What did you do to fix yourself?
It was pretty clear what I needed to do was just check myself in somewhere. And for a change, listen, you know, because my strategy of saving myself just clearly wasn't working. You know, somewhere there was still somewhat of a logical person in there that said, okay, this just doesn't work. You know, you've tried every rule-bending thing you can do here, and then, you know, accept the fact and let's do this thing.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails, and he's composing film music now, too. He did the score, and we won an Oscar for co-composing the score for The Social Network, and now he's co-composed the score for the new American adaptation of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
And he's a depressing guy.
You're not depressed, and are you? Is depression a big issue for you now?
No, I feel great now. I addressed my issues, and I continue to address them, and I've seen a dramatic change in every aspect of my life. You know, I like myself again. I'm able to have mature relationships. I'm able to be a good friend. I'm a father. And I think that my art has gotten much better. And I enjoy the process of making it now. And I really couldn't ask for more. You know, I feel strangely optimistic about everything.
Do you worry that when your kid becomes a teenager that they'll be a sullen teenager alone in their bedroom feeling the kind of anger and listening to their contemporaries' version of Nine Inch Nails? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah, I assume there'll be lots of that ahead of me.
Right.
And ahead of him. Yeah.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Let's hear another Nine Inch Nails song, and this is another kind of another one in the canon of Nine Inch Nails songs.
Play a happy one just to break. Oh, wait, there aren't any.
Yeah. I was thinking, yeah, I missed those. So this is from your debut album, Pretty Hate Machine, and it's Head Like a Hole, which was the first Nine Inch Nails singles to kind of break in the top 100. You still perform this? When you were performing?
Yeah, that would make its way into the set list.
Okay. So this is like angry, I'd rather die than give you control. And so let's hear it.
Got money, I'll do anything for you. Got money, just tell me what you want me to. Got money, nail me up against the wall. Got money, don't want everything, he wants it all. No, you can't take it. No, you can't take it. No, you can't take that away from me. No, you can't take it. No, you can't take it. No, you can't take that away from me.
That's Nine Inch Nails from their debut album. My guest is Trent Reznor, who's now composing film music, too. So, you know, there are two lines in that. Bow down before the one you serve. You're going to get what you deserve. What did that mean to you when you wrote it?
Well, I haven't been asked that question for a while. I'd have to refer back to my 22 or 3-year-old self to see what was going through my head. I don't have a great answer for that right now.
Because you don't remember?
I've been thinking about... I've just been... I don't regularly spend a lot of time thinking about the darkest period of my life. So when I do, it tends to throw my day off a little bit here. So
right. Okay.
What was I thinking in 1989 when I wrote that song? I can't tell you off the top of my head.
So let me read you something that New York Times music critic John Pareles wrote about Nine Inch Nails in 1996. Wrote about you. He said, he traffics in transgression, blasphemy, and primal howls of rage and despair, yet there's no anarchy in his music. With Nine Inch Nails, he works himself up within meticulously dramatic, genre-bending arrangements. Every thud and crunch is plotted in detail with melodies, and he turns punk fury into sonic theater. And I think, I mean, that's true in the sense that, I mean, you really are composing. It's not like noisy noise, it's more composed noise.
I'm trying to read if that was an insult or not. I'll have to have a word with that man. Well, here's my thoughts on that. I did not grow up in a cosmopolitan environment. I grew up in a little town in the middle of nowhere, pre-internet, pre-college radio. There wasn't even college radio around me. And my input for the first 16, 17 years of my life was AM radio, FM radio, pretty mainstream stuff. You know, Rolling Stone was probably about as edgy as it got. And I think growing up on a solid diet of listening to melodic-based pop music instilled in me that format of hooks and something to grab onto. And as I started writing music and considering how to write music, it would always come back to something that was memorable. I'd try to think in terms of choruses and hooks and melody, even if that was set in a very atonal or noisy environment. And I realized a lot of music I liked at the time was hinting at the same sort of thing.
Like what?
The first Jesus and Mary Chain record. It sounded like fuzz on the needle. Like when you put it on, you thought, I don't even know what this is. A couple listens into it. Oh, it's almost... Beach Boys-esque pop songs buried under a layer of fuzz that made it feel funny when you listen to it. My Bloody Valentine, another band that behind walls of noise were lots and lots of memorable, interesting melodies, you know, that made you return to it. And I found that compared to some other acts like, say, Einstürzende Neubauten or like Skinny Puppy, for example, that was primarily experimental noise, although I liked the sound of it and I liked the attitude and the anger, there was something that I missed You know, I missed the fact that you couldn't sing along or you couldn't remember. There wasn't some phrase you could chant back for the most part. And I think when I finally got around to writing Nine Inch Nails music, it started to become personal lyrics that felt out of place with contemporaries that were making music that could sound like I did. An emphasis on chorus, things like, you know, pop song kind of structure creeping its way in there. I know at the time, if you would say pop song, that was a bad phrase, you know. But I never felt that way. I've always tried to flirt with accessibility. I think it's easy to make impenetrable music that nobody can get, and you can hide behind that sometimes. You know, I kind of like the idea of subversively working your way into people's heads, and then you can say whatever you want.
Well, you know, you had a really interesting music background. You say you grew up with, like, you know, AM and FM radio. That was the music. But also, you were in marching band in school, and you were in the musicals. You were Judas and Jesus Christ Superstar. You were Professor Harold Hill, Mr. 76 Trombones, in the school production of The Music Man.
I had it all, yes.
No, but so that must have gotten under your skin, too. I mean, there's so many great, like, show tunes. So if you're in musicals as a kid, I mean, I think your brain always has a special place for that kind of music.
I just always liked music, you know. And, again, I wonder in these times, you know, raising a son in a world with endless amounts of information and entertainment options and diversions, what that's like. You know, when I grew up, it didn't seem like there was a lot to do. You know, there certainly wasn't anything going on in this town. You didn't have access to the types of information you have today. And I was very interested in music. And I was excited about the idea of learning how to play a trumpet or a saxophone. And I joined every school band type thing I could get into just to kind of see what it was like. You know? And I was good at it. And I found my identity kind of forming around that, you know, and it provided some framework that seemed interesting to me, you know. And it wasn't until around puberty that started to focus itself into, you know, I think rather than being a concert pianist, I might want to be a rock star. That sounds cool. That sounds like an escape. That sounds like a kind of unrealistic fantasy that feels like it should be pursued.
So concert pianist meaning classical?
Yeah.
So you were really heading in that direction?
I was being urged to when I was around 10 years old, and I felt like I'm feeling a mastery of this instrument coming on, even at that early age, you know, not to sound pretentious here, but I enjoyed it. I enjoyed practicing. I enjoyed playing it. I enjoyed feeling like I could actually express myself, but the idea of dropping out of school and getting tutored and studying with a nun X amount of hours a day, that didn't seem as fun to me when, you know, I could see Gene Simmons on TV.
Gene Simmons, I'm so glad you brought him up. I was going to ask you about him.
I was trying to find a way to work him into the conversation here, and finally, okay.
No, because I read that you were like a really big fan of Kiss, so I need you to explain that to me. I'm a little too old to have grown up with Kiss, so they really didn't, like, speak to me. However, I know they did for a lot of people who subsequently formed, like, really important bands. And I had this kind of infamous interview with Gene Simmons. We didn't hit it off really well. I mean, he's not exactly, yeah,
why.
He's not exactly a sweetheart. but anyway, so what was, as somebody who's become, like, a really, like, important composer and performer, like, what was it about Kiss that really mattered to you?
I'm just telling you firsthand, I would have been probably 12, 13 years old, around that age, where I grew up and what they represented was the kind of thing you weren't supposed to like, you know, and it felt, through those eyes, it felt dangerous and it felt wildly exciting. It felt like it was rule-breaking. It felt, it represented that kind of male escapism that drew me in, you know, and it was the package. It was the idea that rock and roll, more so than the music ever, it was the idea that it was breaking the rules in some way. It was rebellious. It was not approved by your parents or your teachers. And I think it was the packaging, you know, it was the logo. It was the makeup, you know, it was the whole thing. It was the messaging that it was crossing a line morally somehow.
So let me play another like early recording from Nine Inch Nails. And this is Wish from the 1992 album Broken. This one won a Grammy for Best Metal Performance. I should say we'll bleep this. and it kind of starts like dance music for people who are too angry or depressed to dance. Did you ever think of it that way?
Honestly, no, I haven't. But I will add that to my lines I say about this.
Did you ever think of yourself as making dance music in your own way?
Yeah, kind of. You know, I like the idea of adding rhythm, and I thought that, you know, a lot of the influences that I have come from that world to a degree, you know, with a harder edge to it, sure.
Did you dance? Do you dance?
Not publicly these days, but it's been known to happen.
Okay. So this is Wish. This is the first day. That's Nine Inch Nails, recorded in 1992 from the album Broken. That was Wish, and my guest is Trent Reznor, who basically is Nine Inch Nails. And now he's composing film music, and he won an Oscar for co-composing the score for The Social Network, and he's just composed the music for the new American adaptation of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Nine Inch Nails is basically you, the recordings. I mean, on stage you have musicians, but the recordings are basically you. Did you grow up making, in spite of being in band in school and stuff, did you grow up without people who you could play the kind of music you wanted to play with?
I mean, Nine Inch Nails ended up being just me because I ultimately couldn't find, you know, this would be in Cleveland where I was living at the time. You know, what I wanted to do, I couldn't find anyone else that really wanted to do that same thing.
That thing being mixing a kind of more avant-garde, ambient, electronic, industrial sound with hooks, with melody.
Yeah, what you just said. No, I mean, a lot of it, the vibe in Cleveland at that time, and there was a fairly healthy kind of band scene there, but it was a handful of bands that were thinking that they could just, if we just keep playing this circuit of clubs, magically, some A&R guy from a record label is going to show up and see us and sign us, and then we'll be, you know, off to the races. But in the history of Cleveland, I don't think that ever happened. But it was the myth that kept you rehearsing in basements and playing every week at these same clubs. And it seemed to me that the emphasis should be on trying to define a new sound and writing a catalog of music and defining a new voice and finding that voice. So after feeling sorry for myself for a while, I just thought, well, I'll just try to do it myself. You know, I read Prince did it that way. He was a big influence to me. And started working at a studio. I had time at night to use the equipment when nobody was in there. And that seemed like a kind of romantic notion, but it ended up paying off. You know, it was a lot of work, but it was time well spent really honing my craft.
So earlier you said that it's hard to think. I had asked you about what went through your mind when you were writing one of your early songs, and you said it's hard to go back then. It's hard to be the person I was then when I was like in my early 20s writing the songs. So if Nine Inch Nails performs again, and I assume you probably will, are you going to be comfortable doing those older songs and getting into that head again? That
well,
angry, like self-hatred,
yeah,
kind of head.
I mean, some songs mean new things to you over time.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're on stage, I mean, I can say this with complete honesty, that the economics of doing a tour, it usually lasts 70% longer than you wish it would last. It's fun for the first month, you know, maybe 2 months, and then you inevitably reach a point where, okay, I kind of don't want to be in a hotel in Dusseldorf right now, you know, and playing the same songs tonight. But when you get on stage, it takes over. You know, the songs take over. You start to, the songs inhabit you. You live inside those songs. You get placed back in that mindset. And I think primarily my decision to, you know, stop touring with Nine Inch Nails, that had a lot to do with it, you know, because it rubs off on you. You know, I notice I've been doing a bit of press for Dragon Tattoo, and a couple times the interview goes down the same corridor we just went down, you know, where it's revisiting some places that I wouldn't choose to normally in my day start thinking about, and lowest points of your life, rethink about that, live that for a while. It sticks with you. And the rest of my day today, there'll be a hint of that in the back of my mind.
Oh, you're welcome.
Just, yeah, thanks for that.
Yeah.
See, I'm suffering from my heart even in this interview right now.
Well, Trent Reznor, it's really been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
And
right, I'm going to go hang myself now.
Trent Reznor of the band Nine Inch Nails. He co-composed the score for the new film adaptation of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. The film opens this week. The soundtrack is available as a download now and comes out on CD next week. You can hear three tracks from it on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward talks about the mysterious band The Left Banke that had the hit Walk Away Renee. This is Fresh Air. Mid-60s New York wasn't known for developing new bands. A lack of places to play and a music business that didn't tolerate amateurs was just two of the handicaps bands face. With connections, though, you could make it. And that's how one of the most mysterious and legendary New York bands, The Left Banke, came to be. The band was best known for the hit Walk Away Renee. Rock historian Ed Ward has their story today.
New York teenager who played an instrument and wanted to be in a band, and all of a sudden British groups were coming to town and attracting rioting mobs of teenage girls, you might feel a certain urgency to get something together. Tom Finn had already had a band, the Magic Plants, when he ran into a guy named Steve Martin Caro, a Spanish high school student, recently arrived in the city, as they attempted to navigate the scene outside the hotel where the Rolling Stones were staying in 1965. The two became friends and decided to form another band, so with Tom's friend George Cameron and his old drummer Warren David Schierhorst, they went to World United Studios, where the Magic Plants had recorded, and ran into another 16-year-old named Michael Brown. Brown had a number of things going for him: classical keyboard training, immense talent, and not least, he was the son of the guy who owned the studio, Harry Lukofsky, and he had a set of keys. Late at night, after the day's sessions were over, the kids would get together and work on songs. Martin, Finn, and Cameron turned out to be natural harmonizers, and Brown's keyboard skills helped them find melodies that showed that off. They actually got good enough that Brown's dad, who not only owned the studio, but was a session violinist who did jazz gigs under the name Hash Brown, took an interest and signed them to a management deal. They called themselves The Left Banke, Banke with an E at the end, and they started recording.
Up to now I've been
Except for the drums and harpsichord, everything on I've Got Something on My Mind was played by session musicians. Tom and George hadn't really learned to play their instruments yet, but their vocal blend with Steve, the lead singer, was what this recording was all about. Then, one of the two competent musicians got fired. Apparently, Lukofsky got word that his son and Warren were running off to California together and had them stopped at the airport and kicked the drummer out. More trauma lay ahead. Tom Finn had a girlfriend named Renee Fladden who came to the studio with him, and Michael was mesmerized by her, although he didn't dare do anything. Well, that's not quite right. What he did was write a song.
And when I see the sign that points one way, the love we used to pass by every day.
As badly recorded as it was, Lukofsky had no problem selling the master of this to Smash, a division of Mercury Records. And, after the song hit the radio, it had no problem becoming a top 10 hit in the summer of 1966. Nor was Renee's muse through with Michael. She also inspired the follow-up.
I had a date with a pretty ballerina. Her hair so brilliant that it hurt my eyes. I asked her for this dance and then she obliged me. Was I surprised? Yeah. Was I surprised? Well, not at all.
This too was a hit, albeit a smaller one, and Smash followed it up with an album in early 1967. The Left Bank were set. Well, except for one detail, they still couldn't play their instruments. They were booked on rock package tours and were really only capable of playing three of their own songs, two of which were the hits. By the end of this experience, they all hated each other. Lukofsky didn't help. He fired the two men who'd done the best they could with his awful studio sound, Steve and Bill Jerome, and then he started firing the band, too, trying to build something around his son and Steve Martin, the lead singer. It was a mess, and it got to be an even bigger mess when Smash started asking where the next single and its album were. Delicate negotiations resulted in Michael, Steve, Tom, and George going into the studio where Michael produced a song. Towards the end of 1967, Desiree scraped the bottom of the Hot 100 for 2 weeks before vanishing, along with Michael Brown. In came the lawyers, and when the dust cleared, Tom Finn, Steve Martin, George Cameron, and Rick Brand, who'd been with the band briefly, were the Left Bank. In the summer of 1968, the Four Tops were riding high with their own single of Walk Away Renee, and Smash released the album Left Bank 2, spelled T-O-O, of course, and it sank immediately. The Left Bank was over. Michael Brown showed up in a few more projects, but American taste was turning away from pop. A few reunions without Brown happened in the 70s, and they made some later recordings that were never released, but the magic was all on that first album. Sometimes you have to just leave well enough alone.
Ed Ward is Fresh Air's rock historian. He has two Kindle publications, The Bar at the End of the Regime and Two Blues Stories. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Sue Spolin directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.